Hello and welcome back to continuing coverage of the United Astrology Conference from St. Louis. No, wait, New Orleans, Louisiana. My name is Eric Francis, your host for this extravaganza, and my guest at the moment is Kelly Lee Phipps, who I always think of as the video guy. Like, I've actually, I don't think I've ever seen you not attached to a video pack.
Mm, yeah, well, I got inspired to do video just to start projecting the images of astrology in the world through YouTube and whatnot.
Right. So, but you are also an astrologer.
Oh, I've been doing it for 27 years.
Awesome. And you've got a book coming out called The Tao of Astrology. You say you've been working on that for 12 years?
Yeah, ever since I released my first book, Celestial Renaissance, A Revolution of Astrology. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about these concepts for 12 years, and now it's all culminating in the next 3 months, becoming sort of my life's work under the Uranian opposition here.
You mean you're down to the final edit on the
yes.
on the project?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And it's culminating with this aspect that gets you to a new place.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you sum up the message of the book?
Well, as astrology was being developed by the Greeks, you know, 575 BC when you had the Uranus-Neptune-Pluto conjunction, over in China, the Taoist philosophers were wondering about, how's nature work, you know? And so this book synthesizes ancient Chinese philosophical Taoism with astrological interpretation. For instance, I look at each archetype through five elemental phases. For instance, like Aries would start off in the fire phase as being more primitive, like the daredevil, the thrill seeker, let's go bungee jumping. But then at the earth phase, he grows into the warrior, trying to defend the village, the adventure on a quest.
What sign would that happen in?
We're talking about Aries archetype here, how it goes from... You know, the archetype itself of Aries progresses through five phases.
I see. Got it. Yeah. So if you take the Aries archetype and you look at it through the five
element flow
element system,
because their elements aren't really elements like our psychological elements. They're just more like phases in the cycle of change. So Aries would go through the daredevil, the warrior, the leader, the pioneer, and then finally the champion, the hero.
In metal element.
No, it wood is the highest. So I
wood
start
is
with
the
fire,
highest.
Earth, metal, then water, and then wood. That's how it goes in the
So yeah. What does a water warrior do besides join the Navy?
Well, at water phase, they become humanitarians. They open their heart. All the signs do. And Aries in particular becomes the pioneer, the trailblazer. But suddenly, because they've been a leader for a while at metal phase, and suddenly they're like, what is my unique style of leadership? Oh, now I have to pioneer and trailblaze and start a new thing to reach the hearts of the
people.
So
how do you actually work this out when you're looking at someone's chart?
When I'm looking at someone's chart, like for instance, say somebody has a planet in a sign, like let's say I'm looking at a planet in Aquarius, like the moon in Aquarius, and I'm like, oh yeah, the traditional interpretation, like, oh, you have the soul of the humanitarian, you know, talk about fixed air, talk about all the different things you can talk about a sign. But when I get to the archetypal motifs, I really like to break down the sort of the five phases, you know, of the archetypal expression. And let the person know that once you master each phase, you can choose what you want in any situation. So if you're an Aquarian and you're just working at the primitive fire level of being a nonconformist rebel, that can emerge into like an inventor and a scientist.
So let's take Aquarius as an example.
Okay.
So I get it. So the nonconformist, for its own sake, rebel without a cause type of thing would be Aquarius on the fire level.
In the fire level. Then at Earth phase, they get more grounded and they start mixing things and they start being a rebel, but basically mixing things that don't go together and start inventing new things, and they become the inventor, the scientist, you know. And then that at metal phase is about specializing in society, giving something, doing a societal role. Suddenly you got a new system, time to be the reformer, time to be the freedom fighter. And that starts to evolve after a while. You've done that for a while. At water phase, the heart opens. You become the humanitarian and the altruist. You're like, wow, how can I like really serve humanity? We're only strong as the weakest link. And that leads to the wood phase where the spiritual descends. And in wood phase, the Aquarian archetype matures into the cosmic genius, the cosmic prophet seeing the future, the philanthropist who's like, wow, how can we help everyone get their gifts online and really make humanity amazing? Yeah,
right.
So those are the five phases that are on this book.
Got it. Very interesting. So you would then, therefore, take a look at any given placement in someone's chart. Maybe they're having a transit to that position, for example, something happening to their Aquarius moon, and help them think through that placement based on an understanding that they have a number of different options that they can do with that, for example, Aquarius moon.
How do you want to respond? Do you want to be the rebel in this situation? Because sometimes situations need a good nonconformist.
Yes.
In that.
Or do you want to be an inventor in the situation?
Yeah, yeah.
Or sometimes humanity needs a humanitarian.
And exactly. And sometimes the shadow side of the fire phase is more coarse, as in Aries being the daredevil. They're just like, you know, impulsive and risk-taking.
And might hurt others in the process of doing that.
Exactly. But at the hero phase, the shadow's more subtle, like arrogance, you know. I cannot be defeated like Achilles. So, like, the shadow deepens and gets more subtle as the archetype matures. But once you've mastered the whole range, you can be like, oh, in this situation, I can flow like this, mm-hmm. you know.
So well, let's take one more sign and consider it through the levels. Let's pick a sign. How about Capricorn?
Ooh. Capricorn starts off as the realist, the skeptic, you know. They're like, how's this work? You know, the traditional Capricorn, they're always like, what's this astrology crap?
let's take it apart.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what's next? Sorry, I jumped ahead on the let's take it apart. But
yeah. Well, Capricorn goes through, the next phase is like at the earth phase, where they're grounded, like, hey, I could be an entrepreneur. Let's start a business. You know, let's get this flowing. And then they start to grow in terms of like being the manager, from basic manager. Then they start being the guy in charge, the executive, you know. They say, wow, I can serve society by, you know, being organized not just as the manager, but like the guy in charge, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as that grows, they grow into the wise elder at the heart phase, where they're like, even if they're not an old man, they can still be the wise elder.
Water phase.
And then at earth phase, whew, they become the true, you know, the patriarch of the culture, you know, the wise hierophant of the culture, who's really full of radiant wisdom and, you know, it has its shadow side too. You know, once you get up there, you're like, whoa, control.
I can get away with anything.
Yeah, I can get away with anything, you know, so that kind of, we see it in the media every day, you know. But yeah, these five phases are unique in that they also talk about the different emotions of the signs. So every sign has like a base emotion. Capricorn's base emotion is responsibility. The shadow is isolation. On the dampered level, where it's weak, it's just loneliness versus reliability. Like, I want to be reliable or responsible or total determination. So they've mastered determination at that higher level. They're just like, I'm so focused, I can accomplish anything. I'm like the goat. I can go to the top of the mountain, you know. Whereas like Aquarius is excitement / defiance is the shadow.
Right.
You know? So these emotions really radiate through the chart.
This is a great diagram. Is this online anyplace, or is it going to be?
It's in the book.
Waiting for it to come out in the book.
It's in the book, which will be coming out this fall.
And the book again is called The Tao of Astrology,
mm-hmm.
and you're in the final edit now.
Yeah.
Have you got a publisher, or are you doing it yourself?
I'm doing it myself. Yeah.
Great.
Well,
yeah. If you can do it yourself, go for it.
I am. And it really draws on the structure of a tree. There's a diagram I just wanted to show you. Imagine the inner structure of a tree with the tree rings. The center is the spirit, the pith of the tree, and then there's the archetypal level. This is called the heartwood, where everything's arranged and everything goes in and out. And then there's the xylem, which is the water of the tree connected to the roots. So it's like the emotions of the tree. And the xylem meets the phloem, which connects to the sky through photosynthesis. And this is like the mind compared to the heart. And when they meet, it's called the cambium. And it's a single cell of one cell thick layer.
The cambium in a tree is one cell thick that separates two layers of the tree trunk.
Yeah, the xylem and the phloem, basically the heart and the mind of the tree. And the bark is symbolic of the body. So I'm using the inner structure of a tree because every year they form one new ring of experience. So when emotions come from the core and come over this, if we have knots, we will take on that. It shapes our attitudes, our beliefs, our behaviors. And when they rise into the surface conscious as thoughts, then they sink back down. They take their place in the rings, like memories, beliefs, attitudes. And then further behaviors manifested through the emotional core rising up from the archetypal depths.
The tree grows from the inside?
Yeah.
And it pushes out all the other rings?
One layer at a time, yeah.
So that the, obviously the tree is getting bigger, so
well,
that means the outside layer is stretching.
Yeah, well, it forms a new ring around the old rings. So the tree rings are a map of the history of the tree. And we have that inside us because we're in symbiotic relationship.
Where's the ring forming?
The ring is forming right at the cambium.
So the new ring is on the it is born on the outside.
Yeah, and it grows out. And then old dead cells get pushed out and become the bark. And the bark symbolizes the physical level of, like, the body, the outer form you can actually touch. You know?
Right.
So
and see.
And
yeah.
See.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah, so it's a cool model. Bringing in nature right into astrology with consciousness.
Well, I mean, nature is part of consciousness. Part of, they're one and the same thing, really. I mean,
Exactly.
You know, how can you separate them? But if you do separate them, that's when we start to have problems.
Yeah. Because this here is the diagram that also brings in the instincts. I've related all the instincts to the houses, like the attachment versus detachment. That would be Taurus versus Scorpio. You know, the eighth house would be like, oh, we're letting go, whether we're dying or investing something or having a good sexual experience. It's all about detachment, really. Whereas like Aries would be the first house would be actualization versus cooperation. You know, so these are the instincts, and then around that you have the basic image of the archetype. But then you have the emotion and the mental. And then I'm bringing in out here the plot motifs. Every story has a plot motif. Like if you combine Gemini and Libra, that's love and comedy. That's romantic comedy. Everybody wants a good romantic comedy. A quest, Sagittarius, for redemption, Pisces. So all the plot motifs that form every single story we've ever heard come right out of the zodiac. I boil them down to the 12 and they fit in perfect. Mm-hmm. So this is one way you can reinterpret a chart. Like if someone has a sun in Leo, it's like, oh, you're walking a path of the king, and there's a theme of rivalry, you know? And your base emotion is delight. I chose delight over joy because delight is of the sun, of the light, you know?
What does Hyperion mean in this context?
Oh,
it's a great book by Dan Simmons, but...
Yeah, well, one thing we've missed out of on Greek mythology, we always talk about the Greek myth, but we don't go back to the source. If you go back to the source, the Titans, there were 12 Titans, 6 women, 6 titanesses and 6 titans, and each one of them symbolized perfectly one of the signs of the zodiac. For instance, Mnemosyne, where we get the word mnemonics or memes, memory. She was the titaness goddess.
Mnemosyne was one of the titans?
Yes. Mnemosyne was the titaness of memory, the lady who gave authority to speech and power, and she was called the titaness of memory, and she and Zeus got together 9 nights in a row and created the 9 muses. You know, all the erotic poetry, epic poetry, music, dance, even Urania, astronomy. So the 9 muses. So basically, she's
born from Mnemosyne and Zeus.
Yeah, and when you line her up with the zodiac, she's totally Gemini. See right here? Mnemosyne. So when someone can bring those myths in of the Titans and Titanesses, you get an understanding that Iapetus, who was the father of Atlas and Prometheus, who created humanity, and Epimetheus, you get a realization that Iapetus was the grandfather of humanity in the great war against the gods. He was the first to use technology. He had a spear, and they called him the Piercer, you know. Mm-hmm. And, basically, his love of humanity, and the whole, you know, all his creations, and everything were amazing. Like we tend to stop at like Prometheus and Atlas in our interpretations, but when you go back to the source, you get a highly illuminating, like big picture perspective. I mean, just the fact that there's 12 Titans, and they line up perfectly with their meanings in the zodiac. It's like, why are we using these? You know. Like, actually, Crius, which is related with Aries, he was called the Ram, and his constellation was Aries, and he was the great warrior in the great war against the gods. So a lot of our meanings go back to the Titans, and I've never seen this in an astrology book yet, so I just, like, need to bring this forth. You know, this is part of the mythic understanding, which leads us into mythic aspects.
Was Mnemosyne also a river in Hades?
No.
The river you drink from to remember?
No.
And then there's the Styx, which you drink from to forget.
Yeah, there was like 7 of them. Like there's Lethe, and they all like met in the middle. I haven't written down somewhere, but I don't have them on the top of my head right now. But yeah, there's one of them was related to that, but I don't think it was called Mnemosyne.
Okay.
But in terms of mythic aspects, basically the 7 traditional planets. I mean, as a modern astrologer, we want to rush to the new and exciting, out there to those big cycle planets, and bring in all the asteroids. You know. But it turns out you can look at the asteroid Pallas Athena and learn. Actually, she got her name Pallas Athena because she destroyed Crius's son, who was named Pallas, who was the great warrior after him.
And she took his name.
Took his name. That's how you got a name. That's why she became Pallas Athena. But with mythic aspects, when you take 2 core planets, like, say, Mercury and Venus, well, it creates an alchemical reaction. And in the psyche of a person that has strong Mercury and strong Venus, it creates the Athena effect. In other words, the myth of Athena resonates through the consciousness. And it can happen through a geometrical aspect or just having both a strong presence, like having Gemini rising, being guided by the planet Mercury in your chart, and having, say, like Venus conjunct the Sun and really aspected well throughout the chart. Within that consciousness, there's a strong Mercury and a strong Venus. And because the hermaphroditic Mercury works on Venus to make her like more masculine in a way, she becomes sort of like the goddess of war and wisdom and crafts and civilization and the polis, the city. Whereas, like, say, Moon Mars would be Artemis, wildness of nature. If you meet a woman that has Moon Mars in her chart, she's like, no one owns me. You know, she's like, I am Artemis. They might not know it, but if you speak to that archetype with someone who has a strong Moon Mars, you will and tell them about that. I was actually in Boulder last week talking to a Naropa student about her Moon opposite Mars, and I said, you're like Artemis, the lady of the wilds, who is the virgin huntress. You know, she's like, I just wrote my thesis on the wildness of nature. I'm like, well, it makes sense. You're working out your Moon Mars opposition.
So yeah, I mean, this is a really cool approach to the subject of astrology makes it. It takes it out of the let's memorize it and into the let's combine these different ideas and mingle them and see what we get. And it embraces traditional planets and signs as well as the new material. Where would you describe the Chiron, for example?
Oh, okay, check it out. If you line up the planets with the Earth at the top, kind of like a Kabbalistic-looking diagram, you have the Sun and Moon going down, like a yang column and a yin column. So you have the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Uranus, right? Then you have on this side, you have the Moon, and you have Venus, and then you, on the yin side,
Jupiter,
Saturn, and Neptune.
Ah.
So the more feminine, the four polarities, Sun, Moon, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and then Uranus, Neptune.
Right.
So in the middle column, you have Earth, and then you have Mercury, Ceres, Chiron, and Pluto. And those are the threshold guardians that move between dimensions. Mercury being their king. Mercury's like, I can go anywhere.
He's the only one granted permission to communicate with the underworld.
Exactly.
Right, basically, right?
Well, Hecate too, but Hecate is basically Mercury combined with the Moon. So, and she was a Titaness too, and she basically supported Zeus in his overthrow of the gods and was given a share of the land, the sea, and the sky.
But, very interesting.
But that's where you see it. Any woman that has anybody that has Mercury Moon strong in their chart, they have Hecate energy about them. They know how to make food, the old magic. They know
women's
how to cast
wisdom.
Spells.
It's women's wisdom, yeah. Basically. But so that would be wisdom of really running the household very well.
Yeah.
The alchemy of food making.
Yeah. And also spelling. In the old days, language was magic. If you wrote the word duck on the board and said it, and everybody saw a duck in their head, they were like, oh my God, you're a wizard. So that's why we call it a grimoire. Grammar is about how to put the letters together right to cast the spell. That's why we call it spelling. You know?
Where does that word come from, grimoire?
Grimoire, grammar. That's where grammar comes from, grimoire.
What does that root mean? Is that Gaelic or Greek?
It goes back to the Greek. It's grimoire is like the instructions of how to put something together. And they call it a spell book, a grimoire. You know?
Right.
But grammar comes out of that.
And spelling.
I mean, spelling.
The concept of spelling.
Yeah.
You're actually casting a spell when you spell something, and you spell it right to get it right.
When you drive down the road and see all these signs, they're casting spells. Advertisers know this so well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But the thing about this book is that I'm really going down into the depths with Chiron. What Chiron is, Chiron has to do with the archetype of mentoring, you know, and also single fatherhood, you know. And single, being a single parent, which is prevalent in our society. Chiron's come back, and now single parenting is all over the place. Because he was raised by, like, you know, a shepherd on an island, you know, with help from Apollo. But that whole, like me, I have Chiron on my nadir, conjunct my nadir in Aries. I have my son's name is Arion, and I was a single father of him. I raised him.
Right.
So, you know, that whole, like, sense of, like, the master to the student, you know, is coming back in a more profound way than we've ever seen before, that mentoring exchange, because once you get to Chiron, you're moving out into Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, divine mind, divine love, and divine will. So Chiron teaches you the way to go out there so you don't freaking lose your mind, because you can go crazy out there.
I think of Chiron, among other things, as being the grounding point of the out there energies. It's kind of a utility that helps us access these things that are not so easy to conceive of for most people, like Neptune or like Pluto, but there's a contact point through Chiron that you can get, and it sort of transduces the energy down to a level that a human can work with.
Yeah, when I wrote a recent work called Elemental Wave Chronicles about the Jupiter-Saturn cycle. I just had finished riding my bike 3,200 miles from Boulder, Colorado, all the way through British Columbia, through Seattle, all the way down to San Francisco, and after 4 months on a bike, I was like, it's time to write a book. So I was inspired by the Jupiter-Saturn cycle, and I mapped out every 20-year conjunction for 5,000 years. It took me 3 weeks just to make all the calculations and write them all down, and I wrote down everything that happened in history. This is a book on my website, DivineInspirationAstrology.com, where you can like download the e-book.
Right. Let's say that again slowly, DivineInspirationAstrology.com, where this book will be available.
Yeah, right now it's an e-book, and you can just download it for $5.
Ah.
And it's 60 pages, and what I realized was that with Jupiter Saturn moving back into the air signs in 2020, for the pure air signs, it started in Libra, but it went back to Taurus, so we were in the hybrid period of mixing. Well, back when the Libra conjunction happened in the Hellenistic times, they got Socrates. We got the internet. But the thing is, every time it moves back into the air signs, there's a renaissance on the planet. The last one in 1200 was Scholasticism brought forth the renaissance. However, you keep going back to 400, 800 years before that when the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction cycle every 20 years was going through the air signs. Mm-hmm. And in 400, the Gupta renaissance happened. Basically, which brought forth chess, the Kama Sutra, Bodhidharma, Zen. All that stuff happened. You keep going back 400 BCE, the Greeks, philosophy, astrology, the Stoics, all the Hellenistic culture. You go back 800 years before that, you have, 1200 BCE, you have the rise of the Israelites, Kabbalah, the Hebrew language. You have, at the same time, the Greek Helladic period.
Kabbalah's that old?
Yes. At 1200 BCE is when King David and took the throne. And after the first king of Israel.
What's the relationship? King David as in David and Goliath.
Yeah, David. 1200
David,
BC.
David as in the house of David,
yes,
in which Jesus was born.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the connection to David and the Kabbalah?
Well, all I'm saying is that when air waves come, these elemental air waves, the fire waves bring in the sort of transformation of a new 800-year cycle, mm-hmm, 200 years per element. And when Jupiter and Saturn are making it through the fire signs, there's always scientific revolutions. There's always new charismatic figures. America popped up under a fire wave. Roman Empire popped up under a fire wave. Then it goes to the Earth wave, and there's always advances in trade and population explosions and just Earth, Now, right, we're just coming to the end of that Earth wave, the global industrial evolution, So there's always like that happening. All the way back to the Sumerians, like they invented the shekel, under an Earth wave. Three cycles later, the Lydians come in their earth wave, and they invented fixed location marketplaces called stores and coinage, So every time there's a new advance, and now we're taking the renaissance to the next level. It's going to be a global renaissance beginning in 2020 with Jupiter-Saturn in conjunction in Aquarius at 1 degree on December 21st, 2020. So everybody's talking about the Mayan calendar. It's like, that's just the breakdown process. When we get to 2020, we'll truly be in the global renaissance going back all the way through history, even back in Sumerian times. This blew me away. I went back to Sumerian times. I was like, what happened in their airwave in the 200 years that Jupiter and Saturn were making their conjunction in air signs in the book? Historians call that period the Sumerian Renaissance. I'm like, no way.
So speaking of air, what do you make of the transit of Venus happening in Gemini now in the midst of so much else going on?
A lot, because I have moon at 19 degrees on my descendant, so it's like retrograding back across my moon. So big patterns are shifting, and for me, in relationships, in terms of like completing the inner circle of love within yourself before trying to like go out there and hook up with another and fight over the power. Like when you complete the circle within yourself, and then you attract someone else who has, you have infinity. Then you can see better, and it lasts, has an infinite being within it,
yes,
as opposed to just neat, 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 So I see that as everyone, whenever Venus goes retrograde, being the planet that is related to Taurus and also Libra, which is their intimacy, their emotions are fulfillment and intimacy. So that's what Venus is about, the instinct of attachment and the instinct of cooperation. So with Venus, we're always reevaluating.
Venus as of Taurus is attachment, and Venus and Libra is cooperation.
Yes, those are the basic instincts. I studied instinct theories from all these, because they have thousands of different instincts, like mating instinct, tribal instinct in nature. And so what I did was I said, hey, according to Jung, the instincts or the archetypes are the correlates to the instincts. And as astrologers, we've codified the archetypes into these nice 12 families called the zodiac signs. I was like, you must be able to do the same thing for the instincts. And I've done it right here. And it turns out after I got done, they exactly mean what the houses mean. The instinct for Jim, the third house, was exchange. Because everybody has an instinct like, oh, I'm going to exchange words with you. I'm going to exchange, Mercury, merchant, mercantile. So the instinct of exchange, just as opposed to Sagittarius up here in the ninth house, the instinct of meaning, pattern recognition. So we all have these instincts that work at the body level, and they have a will of their own. And so when you, look at the 12th house, it came out as the instinct of integration versus differentiation or discernment, the parts versus the whole.
Great.
So if we think of the 12th house as the field of integration, it's only the house of troubles when you don't integrate and it becomes disintegration, everything falls apart. It's really the field of integration and holism where emergence happens. One of the big themes in Tao astrology is the science of emergence, where like basically the new thing that emerges from all the parts hooking together cannot be traced back to the parts. It's something new. Like when the Beatles got together, there was something new. They couldn't go recreate it on their own. When hydrogen gets with oxygen, they start off as gases. The water is there. They become water. And then the emergent properties, life. So in astrology, if we look at the focus of the Tao of Astrology is there's all these parts. You know, you got planets and signs and houses and aspects. Those are just the parts. The real human being sitting before you when you're doing a chart is the emergence of those parts. What's the emergent properties that come out? Because then you can put it together. Like someone has, like I have Moon in Gemini with Aquarius, Sun in Sag rising. So I would say you have the soul of the storyteller walking the path of the humanitarian, wearing the mask of the philosopher, you know? So it's that emergence that says, hey, not only do you want to write, you want to write about astrology, and you want to philosophize about it, you know? So it's the bringing it together, you know? Yeah.
Well, this is, in my opinion, a fantastic astrological theory. This is
thank you.
Very cohesive, and it's completely flexible,
yeah.
And it embraces every era of the work, and it's directly relevant and applicable to our actual experience as people. So good work there, Kelly.
It should be coming out in the fall. The Tao of Astrology. I've been working for 12 years.
And it's available as an ebook at...
It will be available in the fall as an ebook at divineinspirationastrology.com.
And we are speaking with Kelly Lee Phipps at the United Astrology Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana. And today is 25th of May. And we're wrapping this up at about 1:40. Got lots of great interviews planned for the rest of the day. Sarah's sitting here a few seats down, very devotedly mixing the audio down into audio tracks, sticking the music on. So Sarah Bisnet Adler is our technician doing this. And the
thanks,
music
Sarah.
You're hearing and the music you are hearing is my buddy Yasa from London, who's out traveling the world someplace. But he composed original composition you will not hear anyplace else. All right. Once again, for Planet Waves FM, my name is Eric Francis. Thank you for tuning in. Kelly, thank you. Congratulations on culminating 12 years of work.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in a little while.